All right, we're ready for Genesis chapters 3 and 4. This is the outline we're following on the book of Genesis. The first 11 chapters deals with early history. Beginning at chapter 12, we have the patriarchal history. And we've covered the creation in chapters 1 and 2, and we're ready to look at the fall in chapters 3 and 4. So chapter 1, what was chapter 1 about? All right, 6 days of creation. Chapter 2 dealt with man in the garden. Now, we won't always take time to remember chapter titles, but if you could remember something that identifies a chapter title, a chapter, some title you give it to yourself or one that we give, it'll help you in future studies so that when you're studying or you're hearing a sermon preached or somebody make reference to a particular chapter, whether it's in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, whatever, it ought to bring something to mind to you. All right. Chapter 3 now deals with Adam and Eve in sin. Adam and Eve commit sin. That's really the storyline of chapter 3. Now, there's more to it than that. We have some ground to cover. But let's take a look at verses 1 to 5. We have here the serpent tempted Eve. Let's get the story, and then I want to come back and talk about the serpent, the nature of the serpent. The text says the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field. The idea of being cunning was that he's sly, he's prudent. Same word, by the way, translated in the book of Proverbs as being prudent. We think of the wisdom of the prudent. He is wise in the sense that he knows how to accomplish his purpose. We see his wisdom unfolded here. But anyway, he's more cunning than any beast of the field. And he came to the woman and he said, "You shall, has God not indeed said, let me start over at verse 1, that which the Lord God had made, and he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" Now, I'll stop just for a moment to talk about how he tempts, other than through the lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, and the pride of life. And we see that at verse 6 here in just a moment. But what's interesting to me here at verse 1 is that he makes the small restrictions of God seem like God has really, really restricted. Because God said you could eat of any tree in the garden. Every one of them you can eat of, but one. That's a small limitation. But he made it appear like that God had really, really put large limitations on them. Did God say you couldn't eat of every tree? Is that, in other words, this is a bad thing. And God and Satan does the same thing with us today, that when God lets us do a number of things, gives us many liberties, and yet restricts us in this area, Satan wants to tell us that God has really put the clamps on you and doesn't want you to have any fun, doesn't want you to do anything. But that's another story within itself. So the woman responded correctly, which tells me what? When she said, "We may eat of every tree in the garden, but the one in the midst we cannot, in the day we eat, we shall surely die." What does that tell you about her? Say again. Yes, she knew it and she knew it well. She knew the rule, she knew the law, she understood the law, she knew it well. It wasn't a fuzzy thing. I'm not sure which tree it was. I'm not sure what he said about the tree. She knew exactly. There's one tree you can't eat, and the day we eat, we surely die. She's got it. More about that in a moment. Then the serpent said, "You shall not surely die." He made a slight change, makes it appealing. And then he gives her the benefit that will come. There is always, from Satan's point of view, benefit and an advantage of yielding to temptation. And said, "God knows," and here's why he gave you that restriction, "that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God, knowing good from evil." And so there is great benefit. You want to do this. So that's verses 1 to 5. Now, let's stop and talk about the serpent. There has been a great deal of, if you read much about modernism, in their approach to the book of Genesis, the modernists deny any reality. The days of Genesis 1 are not literal days. We talked about that last time. The flood was a local phenomena, wasn't a universal flood, they tell us. And when we come to the serpent wasn't a real serpent. That the writers of Genesis, writer or writers of Genesis, as they would put it, are usually simply borrowing from paganistic thought, and they're borrowing language that was understood by the people of the day, they tell us, and describe Satan as if he were a serpent, but this wasn't a real serpent. I want to give you three reasons why I think it was a literal real serpent. And that is, he's identified at verse 1 and in verse 14 with the beast of the field. He was more cunning than any beast of the field. Secondly, the curse was he was to be upon his belly. That doesn't sound like Satan that's just being paralleled or called a serpent, but he was a serpent. And then thirdly, 2 Corinthians 11, 2 and 3, Paul referred to Eve being tempted and said she was tempted by the serpent. Now, so what's taking place? The problem is the modernist can't imagine the serpent talking. This must have been a case where Satan took possession of the serpent's body and spoke. They can't imagine that, but we can imagine God causing a donkey to speak. And if God can do this, why can't Satan with his powers do this over here and it not be so strange to biblical stories? That makes sense? So, I think it was a literal serpent. Now, we could say more about that, but I want us to keep moving. We have some ground to cover. So let's go to 6 and 7. What happens in verses 6 and 7? She was persuaded and took of the fruit and she ate. If you're so disposed to mark or underline things, you might want to mark the three avenues through which Satan tempts are found at verse 6. She saw that it was good for food, lust of the flesh, pleasant to the eyes, lust of the eyes, and desirable to make one wise, pride of life. All three avenues found at verse 6. And so she took and she ate, and she gave to her husband, and he ate. And so the both of the eyes of them were opened, and they knew they were naked. Now we've made a play on this word naked back in chapter 2 and 25. And if you weren't here, go back to chapter 2, 25, underline the word naked. And you might make a marginal note, that means they were nude. And you say, well, we know that's what that means. No, we don't always know that. And I'll see that here in just a moment. So at verse 7, they're still nude. But now they come to realize, because of the knowledge that has been gained, a greater moral understanding has caused them to know and recognize that they're nude, and they made themselves coverings. Now, we won't have time to go into that, but whether you're looking at a lexicon like Licinius or Brown, Driver, and Briggs or some of the expositors like Leupold, Colin Daitlich, or Pulpit, etc., they all agree pretty much that this was a girdle-like loincloth type of garment that covered the midsection of the body. And I want to get ahead of ourselves to verse 10, that even though they've covered themselves, this was their effort to cover themselves, verse 10 says they're still naked. So you might make a marginal note, they're still naked, though it's in a relative sense. There is some covering of the body, but the Bible describes them as still being naked. We'll make a point about that here in a moment, as you well know. All right, now let's go to 8 through 24, and we have God deals with the serpent and with Adam and with Eve. And the first thing is God questions them. Now, this is quite interesting because there's some very practical things to learn here. What happens at verses 8, 9, 10, and on through verse 13? All right. Verse 8, your translation may say, they heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden. Some of the newer translations, it's not a mistranslation question, it's just what is the best translation, I think. The word for sound would be the voice of God. So they heard the voice of God in the garden. It's not that this God walking and they heard the crunching of the leaves, and that's not the idea, but they heard the voice of God coming through the garden. And in the cool of the day, in the afternoon or the evening of the day, and they hid themselves because of the knowledge that has been gained, and so they hide themselves. Some commentator made the observation, I don't remember who made the point, while they gained wisdom, they also seemed to have gained some foolishness to think they could hide from God. But nonetheless, they are seeking to hide themselves from the presence of God. Now, beginning at verse 9, we have God questioning them, and God asked Adam, where are you? And he said, verse 10,
I heard
I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. And again, we've already made a note to the side, they're still naked even though they've clothed themselves. And so at verse 11, have you eaten of the tree which I commanded you? And what did he say at verse 12? Now this is, we're going to make a point about this. What did he say? Said what? All right, who told you this? And he blames it on the woman and said, that woman that you gave me, she gave me of the fruit and of the tree and I ate. So God asked the woman, what does she say? The serpent did that. All right, now let's talk about the blame game here just for a moment, because here's something to be learned about the blame game. Adam blamed Eve. I think our picture here pretty much shows the concept. Adam points his finger at Eve, said, she's the one that gave me to eat. By the way, God, that's the woman you gave me. Seems to be partly blaming God for that. That woman you gave me, she caused me to eat. Eve points to the serpent. He beguiled me, the King James, or deceived me. All right? Regardless of what Eve did, regardless of what the serpent did, they both knew the rules. Would you agree with that? I know Eve did, because Eve had explained to the serpent, we can't eat of that tree and the day we shall surely die. They both knew the rules, regardless of being tempted, regardless of what the woman did, the serpent did, they both knew the rules. They both knew the consequence. God had told them, the day you eat, you shall surely die. They both had a choice. They could have eaten or not eat. And they both were still wrong. Anything practical we can make of that? Absolutely. How many times have you heard someone when they start drifting away from the Lord, or maybe just quit coming to church, and you talk to them, instead of saying, you know what, I've got a problem, I'm weak, what do they usually do? Blame it on somebody else. Somebody hurt my feelings, somebody said something to me, here's something you didn't do for me, I wasn't included, it's somebody else's fault. Regardless of what Eve did, regardless of what the serpent did, they both knew, they both understood, and they both were wrong. Here's something else I noticed in this story. The charges about others were true. Would you agree with that? Adam was right. Eve did tempt him, didn't she? And God gave her to him. He was right about that. He's still wrong. And Eve was right, wasn't she? The serpent beguiled her. She was still wrong. It didn't change a thing about that. There's something practical in that we'll develop a little bit later. Now let's go to verses 15 and 16. Here's the rebuke and the punishment of the serpent now in verses 14 and 15. God said, because you've done this, you're cursed more than the cattle, more than every beast of the field, and on your belly you shall go. And you shall eat dust and all the days of your life. So there is a curse pronounced upon the serpent because he was used in the temptation. I'm more interested at verse 15. Between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, he shall bruise your head and thou shalt bruise his heel. All right. I'm convinced this is the first promise of a redeemer, but I want to come back to that in a moment. I want to talk about a broader picture first. And so just forget the Redeemer. We don't know, as if we don't know anything about a Redeemer. I just want us to look at verse 15. I will put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman. All right? The fact that the serpent, Satan in the form of a serpent, or has embodied the serpent, is an enemy of the woman. There's enmity. This is our first introduction to enmity, by the way. Between the serpent and the woman, but also, and more importantly, between their seed. That is, the seed of woman, I'm going to come to in a moment, very well may refer to Christ, but obviously includes mankind. And the seed of Satan would have, or the seed of the serpent would have reference to those who are children of the devil. From this point on, there's going to be enmity between the children of the devil and the children of God. Does that make sense? Mankind is going to be an enemy of Satan and his people from this point on. In fact, before this, when the temptation starts. That's the broader picture. What we have here is a picture of, and I'm convinced, though some commentators say that the evidence is shallow, that this is a prophecy of the Redeemer. And you say, how do you know? Well, I want us to turn to Romans 16 and in verse 20. There are a number of passages that allude to this principle that may not directly talk about this. Revelation 12, we don't have time to develop, but Revelation 12 would seem to allude to the principle of Romans, of Genesis 3. Romans 16 and in verse 20, the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. If that's not a inference to Genesis 3, I'm not sure where that refers. And you say, well, that's not a quote. I didn't say it was a quote. I said it seems to be an inference to Genesis 3 of the crushing of Satan. So anyway, other passages talk about a general concept. Here's what I want you to see. It's a picture of a man stepping on a serpent and the serpent biting the heel of the man, injuring the man. Looks like he's going to be victorious over man, as if you stepped upon a copperhead and he bit you, he may very well be victorious and put you down and you're done. But the man ultimately has the blow by crushing the serpent. So read again, verse 15, it's on the screen, that he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. And so obviously this is Satan, and I know it's Satan because John 8 mentions Satan is the liar and the father of it, so he's behind this lie. And the seed of the woman must eventually have reference to Christ. He is born of a woman, Galatians 4 and in verse 4. So I take this, and I think the common thought is that Genesis 3:15 is talking about the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ. Satan had a death blow upon the seed of a woman by putting him to death. It looks like it's over and done. But he ultimately has a death blow upon Satan by his resurrection from the dead. Interesting, same chapter that mentions sin being introduced tells us about the promise of a Redeemer. Does that make sense? Now, I know there is the promise of a Redeemer, even if you could convince me that Genesis 3:15 is not it, there's going to be a promise of a Redeemer before we get through Genesis. Chapter 12, obviously, as we get there a little bit later. Now, let's talk about the rebuke of Eve. What happens with Eve beginning at verse 16, or at verse 16? Three things are going to happen to her. Because she led in this, what? Go ahead. There's going to be pain in childbearing. Her desire shall be to her husband. I take that to mean she's going to be dependent upon him. And then there's something else that is mentioned in 1 Timothy 2. He shall rule over you. She's going to be submissive to him. Do you remember in 1 Timothy 2, one of the reasons the woman is to be submissive to man is because of the order of creation. And also then, this is because of the transgression. Both of those, by the way, are mentioned in 1 Timothy 2, 11 and 12. So that's the rebuke given to her and the consequences for her sin. So the serpent faces consequence. Eve faces consequence. And by the way, 1 Timothy talks about she shall be saved in childbearing. I don't think that means that she's saved by having children. She's saved in spite of the consequences that come with childbearing. That's the point. And so consequences doesn't mean she can't be saved. She's going to be saved in spite of the pain in childbearing. I think that's the point of 1 Timothy. All right, now let's talk about the rebuke of Adam and the punishment for Adam, verses 17 to 19. What's going to happen to him? Yeah, he's going to have difficulty. Cursed will be the ground. He's going to toil. There'll be thorns and thistles, and in the sweat of his face he'll eat his bread, And then notice, from dust you came and dust you shall return. He's going to die. Well, that also is true, though not mentioned, concerning Eve. In the day that you eat of it, you'll surely die. So death comes as a consequence. We're going to see they're separated from God when driven from the garden. But then ultimately they're going to physically die as well because of sin being introduced into the world. So most of our problems are frustration in work, your pain in childbirth, the sickness, disease, and death, all of our frustrations were introduced right here in this chapter because of sin. If it weren't for sin, you wouldn't have death, so therefore you wouldn't have sickness, you wouldn't have disease. And if it weren't for sin, you wouldn't be having to work by the sweat of your brow. And if it weren't for sin, there wouldn't be pain in childbirth. Would you agree? So all of that started right here in Genesis chapter 3. All right, let's move on. Let's see if we can make it a little bit further. Now, 20 to 24, God drives them from the garden. Now, let's see what happens in starting at verse 20. That Adam called his wife's name Eve. And what does that name mean? I think we had a question on that. Or did we not? If we didn't, we should have. Anyway, I'm asking it now. Mother of all living. Means life or living. That's the idea. And so notice at verse 21, this is an important point. For Adam and his wife, the Lord made tunics of skin and clothed them. Now remember, we've been talking about their nakedness. They were naked at verse 7. Verse 10, they were still naked after they clothed the middle section. But God made tunics of skin, and it's not until this point they were clothed. Now tunic, I don't have time to develop. Fred Wright in Manners and Customs of the Bible, ISBE and Gesenius and others make the very same point, and I won't read all of that, that this tunic covered from the shoulder to the knee. Now, 2 points I want you to take note, and you might make a marginal note at verse 21. It's not to this point that God clothed them or that they are clothed. The term naked had been used even though they had some clothes on. So they attempted to clothe themselves and it didn't work well. And so at this point, God clothed them. And who did he put clothes on? On both of them, the man and the woman. So the principle of being clothed, or the need for that, was for both. Now let's go back to verse 21, 2, 3, and 4. What happens here? God drove them from the garden. They're separated from God. They lose the life in paradise. And what else? Yes, and he placed cherubim there. That's the plural of cherub. And exactly their form, we do not know. Angelic-like beings that guarded that, and that's about as much as we know about that. And a flaming sword that turned this way and that way to guard the way of the tree of life. And so this is a survey. And so that's a quick run through chapter 3. We're going to try to make it through chapter 4. The serpent tempted Eve, she yielded and gave to Adam, and he yielded, and then God deals with the serpent, with Eve, and with Adam, and then drove them from the garden. That's the story of Genesis 3. Make sense? Tracking with me? All right. Let's go to chapter 4 now. Chapter 4, I simply call Cain and Abel. Now, there's a lot in chapter 4, so let's start with the birth of Cain. And Abel, verses 1 and 2. Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, which simply means what? Question number 6. His name means to acquire. Yes, and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. She bore again and bore Abel, and his name means, same question number 6, breath or life, and he was a keeper of the sheep, and Cain was a tiller of the ground. So we have the birth of Cain and Abel. Now I want you to, let's look at verses 2 to 5, because there's a practical thing to learn as we connect this to the New Testament. There was a sacrifice, they made a sacrifice, and they worshiped God. Now this text doesn't tell us all we know about that, and that's significant. Because on a cursory reading of this, it would seem like God just arbitrarily accepted one and did not accept the other. Let's get the picture. Verse 3, that they brought an offering of fruit of the ground. The Cain brought an offering of fruit of the ground of the Lord, and Abel brought of the firstlings of the flock. Verse 4 said, the Lord respected Abel's, he accepted it. And then verse 5 says, he did not accept Cain's, and so he rejected that. You've seen this many times in preaching on authority. Cain brought of the offering of the fruit of the ground. Abel brought of the firstborn of the flock. The Lord respected one and did not the other. And I've been asked the question before, why did God do that? This seems arbitrary that I like this one. Hebrews 11:4. So if you can't remember this, make a marginal note right here. Hebrews 11:4 says, by faith, absolutely, Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. That means Cain's was not by faith. How do you do something by faith? By hearing, and hearing by the Word of God, Romans 10:17. So that passage, those passages together tell me God had given instructions, though it's not recorded for us, but God had given them instructions, and one followed and the other did not. Does that make sense? So that's why God accepted one and rejected it. It's not an arbitrary thing where God just said, I just think I'm going to reject one. None of that at all. Now, if God had not given them instructions, then that makes God a respecter of persons, which he is not. Romans, you're supposed to say a chapter here. Romans 2 and verse, this is when you say a verse. 2 in verse 11, Romans 2:11. God is not a respecter of persons. All right. So now, beginning at verse 5b through verse 7, God calls Cain to repentance. So what does God say here to him?
That's why he's so angry. If you do well, he would have accepted your offering. So pretty much said, if you would listen, then I would accept your offering as well.
All right, let's footnote right here. If you didn't catch this during our Sin and Grace series, 7 lessons, I mentioned this verse about 3 times. If you didn't catch it, this is a good time to catch it. Verse 7 makes the point, man can obey God, and man can overcome sin. Because verse 7 said, if you do well, Cain, you could have done well. You can overcome sin. This is a good time to catch that. If you didn't catch that in that series, that's a good verse to remember when people say, we can't do the will of God. We cannot really obey God. We can, and we can overcome sin. Anyway, God calls him to repentance here. And at verse 7, I'm lost my verse. Yeah, verse 7. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And it is, and sin lies at the door if you do not do so. And its desire is for you that you should rule over it. All right, that's what I was looking for. Now, verse 8 beginning, Cain kills Abel. Why does he kill him? He's jealous because God accepted his brothers but rejected him. Whose fault was that? It's Cain's. He made the choice to do what he wanted instead of God's instructions, and now he's upset about that. But be that as it may, verse 9 said, he talked with Abel. Your footnote will suggest he invited him. Let's go out in the field. That's the idea, whether that's a good translation of that or not. Let's go out in the field, and they go out in the field, and then he takes something and kills his brother, rises up and kills him. And so when God asks him, where is your brother? Well, am I my brother's keeper? You know the story. So what does God say to him? Yeah, his blood speaks from the ground, and what have you done with him? And so he tells him, you will be, verse 12, a fugitive and a vagabond. What's a vagabond?
Wanderer,
yeah. It's the idea of you're going to wander around. But he says, Abel says, my punishment is greater than I can bear. I take that to have reference to the feeling of guilt. But God says to him, Cain rather says, I'll be a fugitive. And he thinks at verse 14, I'm going to paraphrase, that somebody may up and kill me now because of this being put upon me. Now look at verse 15. You might underline the whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken upon him. Sevenfold. We'll make a point about that in a moment. And God set a mark on Cain lest anyone should kill him. All right. There's a great deal of question about the mark that is upon Cain. I believe it's the Mormons that talk about a mark? There's one group that talks about a mark, and some think this is the beginning of the black race, and that was the color of his skin change. There's nothing in the text. There's nothing give us any clue of that kind of thing. This was a mark for his protection more than a mark for his curse. Does that make sense? Verse 15 tells me, I put a mark on Cain lest anyone find him. Now, how did God mark him? We don't know. The text doesn't say. So when somebody says, and there have been some said it was a deep gash on his face, how do you know? Is the color of his skin a birthmark? I don't know how God marked him. Or was there a physical mark somehow? Or is it that God just took note of the fact to keep him from, I don't know, but God put a mark on him to keep him protected so that no one would kill him, lest anyone kill him. How did he do that? Anything else is speculation. We're going to leave it at that. All right, now let's begin at verse 16. Now this gets into the section we sometimes would like to skip as if it's unimportant. But this raises a question now at verse 17. Cain knew his wife, and where'd she come from? So here's a couple of notes you might want to make in the margin of your text. That question assumes that there were only four people in the world at the time. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, and now he's ready to marry a wife, and that's making a big assumption. You'll see why I say that. Let's jump ahead to chapter 5. There were other children by Adam and Eve, the text tells us. And so these texts are not necessarily in chronological order. That is, the having of the children, did that happen after this matter? Or I don't know. I don't know. Before he married her, that is, before this marriage mentioned, the text doesn't tell us that. The command to multiply and replenish the earth is well underway by this point. Chapter 4, I had you to flag the word anyone and whosoever suggests there were others. So at the time that God puts this mark, lest anyone, well, who else is there? Abel's dead, and Cain and Abel, I mean, and Adam and Eve, the only other two people, if we assume there's only four people. Who's going to kill him? His parents? There's got to be some other people, and those verses suggest that. The one he married had to be a descendant of Adam and Eve. Who else is there besides somebody that's a descendant? Could have been a sister or near relative. Some speculate a niece. There would have had to have been a marriage to a near relative in the early days, as Abraham, for example, married his half-sister. Remember that? Genesis chapter 20. So it's not a big question. That's been questioned by some as if to say the Bible is almost impossible to follow because you got a man marrying and he doesn't even have anybody to marry yet. That's making a lot of assumptions. I want us to get down to verse 23 and 24. The storyline, I'm not going to read all these names as we talked about on Sunday in Matthew, but there is a purpose in mentioning the family of Cain. There's going to be a contrast made at verse 26, and I want us to get to that point, if we can, here in just a moment. So what's the point of mentioning the family of Cain? It seems to be this. To show the spirit of the descendants of Cain were involved in things like polygamy. Here's a man, Lamech, who has two wives by this point. This is a little surprising if you don't know the rest of the Bible and you're just reading. This is a little surprising at this point, isn't it? That by this point we have a man marrying two wives. There's polygamy involved. There's vengeance. We're going to see it, verse 23 and 24. There's murder and there's pride. I think the point is to say the descendants of Cain were already becoming so corrupt, we're going to understand why the events of chapter 6 are going to happen next week. The world had become so corrupt, God's ready to destroy it. It's going downhill fast. Does that make sense? That seems to be the storyline. In contrast, I'm going to come back to 23 and 24. In contrast to Seth's descendants, and we'll put these on a graph next time, what do we know about the descendants of Seth? Seth was born to Adam and Eve, and his name means what? Appointed. Very good. And verse 26 says, then men began to call on the name of the Lord. To me, that phrase, calling on the name of the Lord, meaning worship and serve the Lord, in contrast to the descendants of Cain. Cain was a man that started out in the direction of doing what he wanted to do, worshiping God the way he wanted to, and look where his family went. Does that make sense? Things went downhill fast for Cain's family. There was Seth, his brother, had children, and men began to call on the name of the Lord. Does that make sense? It is through Seth we're going to see Noah, not through Cain. Isn't that interesting? Now let's go back to Lamech. He writes a poem or a song to his two wives and calls for them to listen to his speech. And he said, I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. There is a big question among commentators, and I'm not qualified to get into this. In the tense in Hebrew, is this saying it's something he has done, or is it a warning of what he will do? And so they kind of go back and forth on the tense, and I'll leave that to you to decide. It don't make a big difference to me. But what he's saying is, here's the idea of vengeance. I killed a man for wounding me, a young man. I killed a young man, or will kill a young man, for hurting me. This is the spirit of people like Cain and his descendants. He killed his brother because he had a sacrifice more acceptable. And here's a man saying, seemingly bragging. This seems to be pride of bragging. I killed a man for wounding me. He wounded me and I just killed him. A young man for killing me. And if Cain was avenged sevenfold, remember we flagged that. Back at verse 15 of chapter 4. If you didn't catch that, go back and catch that at verse 15. That vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. In other words, what Cain did doesn't hold a light to what I did or will do. Does that make sense? Kind of like I'm bragging. He killed his brother. I don't hold a candle to what I'll do or what I have done. I just killed a man for wounding me. I killed a man for offending me. And if my ancestor back here had vengeance on him sevenfold, you can count me 77-fold. That's what you can count me. That's pride. No wonder when we get to chapter 6, God's ready to destroy the earth. Look, it's going downhill. Make sense? All right. Now, let's see what else we've got here. The birth of Seth, which we've already talked about, 25 and 26. All right. Any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am. He didn't take care of her. You're exactly right. Question number 7. Let's look at some practical things we have to look at here in chapters 3 and 4. What would you list? Practical things. Diane just mentioned he didn't take care of his wife. He did not. Good practical lesson. What else would you list? Good point. As far as we know, along what Kevin just said, as far as we know, as far as recorded, at that point, God only had one law. Don't eat of that tree. It was not hard to understand. It's a simple law. Don't eat of that tree. And yet what I'm learning from that is how easily we can be deceived. On one law and one law alone, a simple law, they were deceived. And if they could be deceived over that, I could easily be deceived over things that are maybe a little more difficult. So don't ever underestimate the power of Satan. He can easily deceive you and beguile you. Powerful. What else? Practical. Do you take home? Shannon. Good, good point. Very good. Very good. What else? Practical. These are good. Yeah. Bear some responsibility. Good point. It's easy to throw the finger out and blame somebody else. It's your fault. What you did is the reason I've messed up. What else? Practical.
God's punishment. He used practical lessons. They had misused the garden. And now they're going to have to work hard for what they did. They've been given their food before. Now they have to work for it.
Good point. Good point. I learned from chapter 4. Shannon mentioned this in part a minute ago. Not all worship is acceptable. I think sometimes we get the idea, at least in the religious world, we're doing good things. This is worship. We're praising God. It doesn't matter how we do it, just as long as we're praising God. It makes a difference how you worship. Both men brought sacrifice. Both men attempted to worship, but one of them was wrong. One of them was wrong. And so it makes a difference how you worship. Time for one or two more practical things. Good point. We'll give a little chronology next time and may get a little clearer picture that I'm not prepared to give tonight. But as you say, a number of generations have passed. This hadn't been like 4 or 5 years. This has been a number of years have passed by the time we get to Lamech. And he well understood what had happened back there and compared himself back there. And so sometimes this goes on for generations. Go ahead. Good point, good point. Yeah, Eve had to bear responsibility for what she did, but that didn't exempt Adam. He had to bear responsibility for what he did. And the serpent, yeah, you're going to be dealt with too. That's a good point, good point. Good place to stop. We'll end right there.